Commission was smart enough to put limits on ownership precisely because of the kinds of concerns that Jeff Chester is raising. And I couldn't agree with him more, as I used to put it when I was chair of the National Citizens Committee for Broadcasting, trying to build coalitions. I said, whatever is your first priority, whether it's women's rights or civil rights or environmental concerns, your second priority simply has to be media reform. Because with that, the progressive community has a hope, and without it, you don't have a hope.
Nicholas
Johnson, that's what we're up against right now.
Nicholas Johnson, I was startled by one of the things, actually several of the things that Michael Powell said in opening this forum that we're broadcasting here on Pacifica from New York today. He was trying to reassure people, and his way of reassuring us was by saying, the chairman of the FCC now is saying, don't worry, there's not going to be a rule that allows one person to own everything. That was his reassurance. How about if there's two people that own everything? I mean, what is that what it's come to, that we're supposed to be reassured because one corporation isn't going to own all the media outlets?
Well, let me tell you, it's much worse than that, because of the amount that I was able to get off of the Internet today, I didn't hear anybody discussing what I think is the real issue. This is not about diversity of ownership. It doesn't make any difference whether we have one owner or 10,000 owners. What makes a difference is what are the rules, the constitutional rights, the legal rights, the regulatory rights with regard to rights of entry into the mass media conduit. That's what the fight ought to be about. When AT&T was in existence, it had a total monopoly. It owned everything from one black telephone to the through the lines to the other black telephone on the end. And yet, if you look back, you will see very few, if any, suits filed by the ACLU or others complaining on First Amendment grounds about an interference with speech or a lack of diversity. Why was that? It was because the rules were anybody had a right to a telephone. And once they got the phone, they had a right to say anything over the phone they wanted to say, at least a right so far as the conduit owner, the AT&T, was concerned. You might get in trouble with the police for some fraudulent transaction or giving away national security secrets, but AT&T wasn't coming down on you. Now, what the Supreme Court has said, and I haven't heard anybody say this morning, what the Supreme Court has said is that with the First Amendment right to speak goes a First Amendment right to censor. Now, that may be all right in terms of an op-ed piece that you or I might write for a newspaper, that nobody should have a right to put something inside our op-ed piece we don't want to say. But when you're controlling a monopoly stream, to give the media owner that power is so directly contrary to what the founders of this nation had in mind as to be absolutely outrageous.
Well, Nick Johnson, let me try
Nicholas
to...
Johnson.
Oh, go ahead,
Nicholas
Robert.
Johnson, this is Robert Knight in New York. First of all, I'd like to offer my condolences on your adventures in dot communism, but I'd also like to take advantage of your experience as an FCC commissioner to help us understand how these decisions are made. Does each commissioner have access to his or her own lobbyists and then come into the room and make a pre-made decision and vote? Or is there lobbying among the commissioners on the model of the Supreme Court?
Well, I don't think there is any model, but the process is the commissioners' offices are besieged with industry representatives, industry literature, industry filings by very expensive lawyers and others. My rule of thumb was, if you got anything you want to say to me, let's call all the commissioners together in the room and open it up to the press, and you can tell us right there. I don't want to have any private conversations or whatever. But not everybody follows those rules. I thought it inappropriate to go to lunch and have an industry person pick up the tab on the lunch. But not everybody views it that way. And that's part of what Jeff Chester is talking about, with the need for the public to get involved in this process, because otherwise a commissioner is just totally surrounded by nothing but an industry point of view. Documents are drafted by the FCC staff. Bear in mind that 90% or more of what the Federal Communications Commission does never comes to the attention of an FCC commissioner any more than every decision of the federal court system comes to the attention of the Supreme Court justices. So what does come to the commissioners would usually involve a presentation from staff, the staff of the FCC. And then which commissioners talk to each other and how often and about what and so forth is going to differ from commissioner to commissioner. If you don't want to differ with what's proposed, all you have to do for 7 years is put your hand up in the air occasionally and vote aye or nay. In my case, I chose to write dissenting opinions in a very substantial proportion of the cases, so I had to do a hell of a lot of writing during the lunch hour of the meeting. But that's kind of how it goes, and it's up to the individual FCC commissioner really to write his or her own job description.
There's a major constitutional issue here, which is alluded to several times, although not tackled head-on. Mostly, the best attack on this question was by Juan Gonzalez, as one might imagine, this morning, where he said quite out front, you're talking about form here, but then there's content. When these corporations take over more and more television stations or radio stations they now have, even if they do what they crow about is more and more local news, the local news are either police-oriented horror stories or scheduled staged events that they can get pre-digested and pre-recorded tape on. They're not really going out and covering what any news person, like Juan Gonzalez, would consider to be news. For him, he said, for many of us, journalism is not just like selling cornflakes. It's a vocation, and it's a vocation with a social mission. But that kind of thinking is completely foreign to corporate owners of media, and the more of them that take over radio and television stations, the less of the type of news that Juan Gonzalez and others of us have dedicated our lives to, like Robert Knight and myself, and the more of what you now see on the flash and trash ratings-oriented television news stations you see.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. But the point I was making earlier is that while a newspaper may choose to run your letter to the editor, while the call-in talk show may choose to take your call, you have no legal right if they wish to exclude you. So you do not have a right to buy an ad in the New York Times or in the San Francisco Chronicle with a case of your two stations. If they don't want to accept your money and they don't want to accept the content in your ad, there is no way you can force them to do it. The Supreme Court has said. It has said the same thing with regard to television stations. It has said the same thing with regard to radio stations. It has said the same thing with regard to cable. It has said the same thing with regard to St. Patrick's Day parades. And it has said the same thing with regard to the PG&E billing envelope out there in California. So with the First Amendment right to speak goes the First Amendment right to censor, which means that well over 99.9% of all Americans have no meaningful and effective First Amendment right at all. And once you recognize that's what we're talking about, then it's not just a matter of the numbers of owners. It's not just a matter of the co-ownership of the content and the conduit, which Jeff Chester talked about to some degree, as abhorrent as that overlap is, and absolutely outrageous that you would permit the owner of a cable distribution system to also own the sources of programming that run on that cable system. But as outrageous as all of that is, the problem is that there is simply no way for the excluded to get their message out at all. And that's before the FCC makes it even worse than it already is.
Well, Nicholas Johnson, we're going to give our listeners here a way of getting the word out. First, we want to thank you for being with us. Nicholas Johnson now has been for many years a teacher of law at the University of Iowa Law School, and he has a website, www.nicholasjohnson.org. We have 5 or 10 minutes before we go back live to the Kernikan Center for Law, Media, and the Arts. And Robert Knight, what's going on there in New York?
Well, at the moment, we have our own Democracy Now!'s Amy Goodman, who is standing by at Columbia University Law School with some guests, and she now joins us live. Amy Goodman, you are on the air on Pacifica's national broadcast on media ownership.
Maybe not quite on the air yet, Robert. We'll take a little musical break and see if we can get Amy live from Columbia Law School with a phone.
We're right here on the line.
Oh, no, we got her now. Okay, go ahead.
We're broadcasting here from Columbia Law School, the forum on media ownership, and I'm standing with two people, with New York Congressmember Gerald Nadler, as well as Cheryl Bianza, who is with the Media Access Project, one of the community groups that really were the force behind this forum today. I wanted to start with Congressmember Gerald Nadler, seeing the growth and consolidation of media in this country at this point. Is your response to these hearings what Congress can do?
Well, Congress can do a number of things. I mean, first of all, we have the danger that the FCC is conducting biennial hearings with a view really towards dismantling what few restrictions on the ownership of media we have. The Telecommunications Act that Congress passed in 1996. The largest owner had, at that time had 130 radio stations. As far as 6 years later, he's got 1,400 radio stations. This is disastrous from any kind of view of maintaining democratic government with less diversity of views. I mean, five major corporate owners now control almost everything we see on television and so forth and cable. And you can't maintain democratic government if there are very few people who control what you see, what you hear, and what you read. And what Congress should do is to repeal the mandate to review the cross-ownership rules every 2 years and should reimpose the cross-ownership rules, say that you cannot own more than one TV station, one radio station in the same place where you own a newspaper, reimpose rules of that type.
Cheryl Lianza with the Media Access Project, you are one of the groups that really started this ball rolling and demanding that public somehow get access. We see that first there was going to be one dissident commissioner here, who is Michael Cox. Now they're all here. Can you talk about why, what happened, and where you're going from here?
We got all the commissioners here today because they are realizing that the public will not be silent and that the public does need to be involved in discourse and understand what the FCC is going to do as part of this democratic process. I think Commissioner Cox was extremely smart to ask the FCC to go out to the public and find out what the public thinks. And I think this is the beginning, hopefully, of a increasing groundswell of the public learning more and more about this issue. I think the media needs to respond to the challenge that they cover this issue in a responsible way so that the public is at least aware that it's happening. We're going to see more hearings across the country, more forums across the country, in California, potentially in Seattle, potentially all around the country. So I think this is a good forebear of future information.
And at USC, you'll be holding a hearing?
Certainly, we're not holding the hearing, but I believe that USC Annenberg is going to host a hearing. It's actually a forum. It won't be an official hearing by the FCC, but they'll be hosting that in February.
And what about FCC Chair Powell's response today?
The FCC Chairman today tried to blame his deregulatory agenda on court decisions. Those court decisions were decisions that he refused to appeal. And so I think that, unfortunately, he's trying to take those decisions, which he claims to be a victim of, and actually run with them. But certainly I'm gratified that he has come out and begun to see the light that he needs to hear from the public, and I'm gratified that he has changed his tune a bit and is promising the public that he won't fully repeal the rules as he begins to realize that such an action would be completely untenable.
Finally, the only public broadcasters here today, Pacifica Radio broadcasting this forum live, PBS, the webcast of Columbia, but I don't see the networks here. In fact, one of the representatives of Viacom was asked about this, and he said something like, well, we'd be accused of having a conflict of interest, which is how he explained why they're not covering this issue. Your response?
The problem with a consolidation of media is that media companies can make that excuse. if all of the media companies have interests in such a wide range of areas, then no media company can ever step forward and cover these media issues. I think the opposite is true. CBS holds the license and the public trust as a result of their licenses from the FCC, and they have an obligation as journalists, as professionals, and as licensees of the public airwaves to cover all the issues that are important. If CBS doesn't think that its journalists can cover the issues fairly, then I certainly think we've got many, many problems beyond media consolidation. And that's Cheryl Lianza of the Media Access Project here at Columbia Law School on the Forum on Media Ownership. I'm Amy Goodman for Pacifica Radio.
And I'm Larry Benstein, Berkeley, California, with Robert Knight in New York. We will be going back to that forum in about 10 or 15 minutes when it begins its afternoon session with more panels discussing media ownership, regulation, and deregulation. Do stay tuned. Right now, we'd like to let our listeners in on the fun. If you have any thoughts or comments or questions that you might want to ask me or Robert Knight, give us a call at our toll-free nationwide number, 1-800-958-9008, 1-800-958-9008. If any of what we're talking about and the people who have been talking this morning, if any of that has resonance for you, let us know, and we'll talk for a while on Nationwide Talk Radio, one of the features traditionally of our Pacifica National broadcasts, as we try to get those back together. And we can only get those back together with your help. What Amy said is absolutely true. We are the only network that thought it was worth having on today. And we have preempted our regular programming on the stations that are carrying this, the Pacifica stations. If you believe in that kind of broadcasting, you probably know that it's only possible because you listener sponsors make it possible. Our website is www.pacifica.org. That's www.pacifica.org. And you will see an easy way there to click onto a way, a secure way, to make a donation to us to pay for the cost of this broadcast and encourage us to do more. So please do click onto that website, www.pacifica.org. We'll go to the phones now with Chris in Los Angeles. Chris, thank you for joining us, KPFK listener.
Hi, everyone. My question is simply, instead of the FCC rehashing a big media show about ownership rules, why can't we be discussing whether or not we can require broadcasters to cover political debates with elections coming up and giving lots of free space to candidates in order to break the cycle of money in politics? The airwaves are supposed to belong to the people, and that ought to be a perfectly reasonable thing to require of our government and our broadcasters, and I don't understand why that isn't number one on everybody's agenda and the main issue before the FCC right now. Why isn't it that?
Good question, Robert Knight. Your thoughts on that? Why do you think the broadcasters are so resistant to having an obligation, along with the licenses that they're virtually given for free, to broadcast political speech and allow some meaningful discussions to take place at election times?
Well, I would imagine it's related to the same reason that so many of the people's broadcast content has been turned over to infomercials, because the broadcasters have the opportunity, whether through programming or through second sourcing, to maximize profits.
And political ads, last time I looked, I think the figure was $700 million.
And they sell at extremely high rates,
right,
because it's always last-minute buys, and anyone who knows how the advertising market works knows that you know the poor guy who comes in late has to spend more money, and they really make a lot of money on selling the stupid space for those stupid 30-second spots.
Yeah, you're absolutely right about that, and that's one of the reasons, of course, they're going to be tremendously resistant towards giving any of them away, although that's one of the reforms that have been present in early versions of McCain-Feingold, for example, and in other efforts to reform the electoral system in Washington. Thank you for calling, Chris. We're going to go on.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right. We're going to go on now to Charles, who's here in Oakland, California. Hi, Charles.
Yes, what a pleasure it is to have an opportunity to speak with you folks here. One of the challenges in the school systems, you have this TV One that's coming in, and so children are getting at a very early age the media information and being controlled about purchasing and that sort of thing. How best can the average person, because, I mean, I feel like this is sort of like Plato's allegory of the cave where people's heads are locked into place and these shadows are being cast on the wall by these folks in power. I think it's enormously unfortunate that the concentration of media power has happened the way it has. And a lot of people just like, oh, well, I kind of like what's on TV and everything is okay. Certainly this hearing is very powerful. I mean, it's unfortunate that the hearing itself is not being covered adequately, but how else do we get through to the average person to realize that the quality and that their voice is really not being heard?
Those are excellent questions, Charles. On the question of children, we hope to have on, after this broadcast is over, the forum from Columbia this afternoon, and that would be at around perhaps 5 o'clock Eastern Time, 2 o'clock West Coast Time. Patty Miller from Children's Now, Children in the Media Program, and they have a website, which I've been looking at, www.childrennow.org. But this is an extremely important issue, the media consolidation and the type of stuff that is programmed especially for children to orient them, as you say, from a very early age to a consumer mentality and to being plugged in front of the TV with all the type of stuff that's being shown during children's TV programs.
Interestingly enough, one of the speakers in the earlier panels, Representative Gerald Nadler of New York, made a point in his earlier adventures with the FCC, complaining that the FCC has let children's and students' access to the Internet slip through the cracks to some extent. He has complained that the FCC brought to an end the discounted telephone rates for schools and for Internet access at the libraries as well. They're known as the E-rate, and it's about a 40% discount for institutions, including libraries and schools. And so the House of Representatives also did not intervene to prevent the FCC's ending of that particular boon for students.
Karen in Oakland, California, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Just to underscore how important these hearings are, and I am so glad that you're covering it and that someone is looking into it. Several years ago, I tuned in each dial on my radio what was on the stations, and 95% was music. I'm a radio person. I don't watch TV. I don't have time to sit and watch TV. So I listen to the radio and do my work. So I didn't know what was happening, but I documented what was on the various radio stations. So this must have been right after the changes went into effect. So I'm so glad to now understand what has happened. There was truly a change in the coverage. Now, I do have a question, and that is about the AT&T broadband. The former FCC member that you had, Nicholas Johnson, he said something about broadband. I, as a property owner, received a notice from AT&T saying that I needed to sign a contract in order for them to make changes to my building. I have a fourplex. And in order to make changes to my building so they could put wiring in for broadband. I haven't responded to them yet, but I'm not ready to make those changes. So do I have some control as to whether I want, well, apparently I have some control as to whether I want broadband in my building, but is this the way we can tell AT&T we don't want them broadcasting or communicating, that we don't want them to have total control over the communications?
It's an interesting question, Robert. Was it when you I heard, and now I'm beginning to mix these things up because we've heard so many voices, but maybe you remember, was it in your interview with Jeff Chester where he said some of us are going to be walking down a dirt road and others are going to be on a super highway as far as broadband is concerned?
Yes, he did say that. And he said that the accumulation of ownership by a few companies in that field as well could lead to the situation that Nicholas Johnson also referred to in a different way of the backbone provider of the, as he called it, the plumbing of the internet or broadband, being affiliated with providers of content and having the extreme financial temptation of providing second-class citizenship for internet content or communications that are not brought to the Allied Corporation for their profit. Now, as for the specificity of the AT&T question that the caller is asking, I am not an expert on that. That is a regulatory issue, either with the FCC or possibly also with the intervention of local authorities. I wonder if it's related to a provision that there is a there has been a telephone tax that is designed to allow rural or hard-to-access places to have affordable telephone systems as people do in concentrated places like cities. That may or may not be a factor.
Well, but what is a factor, Robert, is that these are monopolies, these cable companies like AT&T in Oakland where she lives and Berkeley where I live. And the rates have constantly been going up way beyond inflation. You don't have any real choice. Let's say all you wanted to watch, like me, was C-SPAN and occasionally ESPN and CNN and MSNBC and Fox, and I really don't give a darn about any of the other stations. I never look at them. I should have an opportunity, given the freedom of choice in this country, to contract for those channels if I wanted to. I can't. I've got to take this huge package. It costs a lot of money. It's very expensive. And 90% of it is stuff I will never look at because it's a cable monopoly. And satellite's moving in the same direction. The FCC deregulation would only exacerbate that situation, as I understand it. Paula,
one of the things that representatives at the recent Commerce Committee hearing of the Senate, one of the points that was brought up a number of times is how these corporations are receiving the income for the broadband project, and yet there is no kickback or return for consumers in the form of their local telephone rates.
Interesting. Paula in Santa Monica, California, thank you for joining us. By the way, our telephone number toll-free from anywhere you're listening to this broadcast is 1-800-958-9008. Hi, Paula.
Yes, hi. I apologize if I'm long-winded. I hope I'm not, but I'm writing some notes to myself to keep myself organized. That's where I want to go with points. I'm really concerned about a couple of issues that have to do with the media's attitude towards Middle America and diversity of all of America. You know, I took a film class in New York, and I was really struck always by the people in the industry. They would talk about everybody who's not an ally in New York being a flyover, which to me was a really disparaging way to refer to all of America. And the media, I mean, the film industry does it simply, it's kind of a short way of talking about the audience out there. But it struck me as a little disparaging. I remember I went to a, in fact, lecture at Columbia University. And I'm kind of, even though I've spent my life as a nurse, I'm kind of a journalist at heart and almost went in the direction of journalism before I became a nurse. And it's, in fact, my big passion and where I head now. And so I was always exposing myself to what the journalists were doing and thinking. So I went to this lecture at Columbia. And I wish I had my notes in front of me so I could tell you exactly what it was that they said. That was.
Well, why don't you give us one or two points, because we got a lot of other callers and we're going to have to go back to this broadcast.
No, that's my point. I can't remember exactly what they said. Well, I'm sorry. But here's the thing I'm trying to get to. They talked also about Middle America in a very disparaging way. And it concerns me because I really do believe, I know, because I talked to enough people and enough of in New York and L.A., because I've lived in both places, that there is this attitude that what is in the middle of part of America really doesn't matter, that it only matters what goes on either coast. And so this FCC ruling, I think, is going to impact that, and I think that intelligent people and people who want to keep their minds open and constantly learn about the world should be afraid of anything that reduces our ability to communicate, you know, if we are in the middle of
Paula?
Yes.
Paula, this is Robert in New York, and I'd like to respond. I think you do make a good point about geographical chauvinism, but I do not agree that the corporations and entertainment and content providers have written off Middle America by any means, and I will assert that with one simple example. The proliferation of sales for African urban rap music, whose market is predominantly Middle American white consumers.
Robert in Menlo Park is our next caller as we're waiting to go back live to the Forum on Media Ownership at Columbia University, which is going to begin momentarily, but we will continue taking phone calls up until the time they reconvene. Hi, Robert.
Hi, good afternoon, everyone. First of all, I just want to say I'm originally from St. Louis, Missouri, and what I see here over there in the Midwest suggests to me that the American people are going to buy into whatever the construction on that is. But one suggestion I have, if you're out of time, is that for local government to become ISP providers and to pass local law that would protect us, at least protect our First Amendment rights. I know in Oakland and San Francisco, they're pretty bold and they're willing to do something like that. Just one last anecdote. I work for a public organization, and some folks were upset because some people were using our listserv to criticize my colleagues. So against my protest, my colleagues voted to cancel the participant listserv. So.
There's democracy in action. Thank you for calling, Rob. We're going to go to Lawrence in Southern California in Culver City. Hi, Lawrence.
Good afternoon. Although good morning. Good afternoon over there, I guess. Anyway, my point is it seems like this Republican administration, being right-wing fascists that they are, have been able to, again, advance their agenda, you know, starting with the FCC ruling and now beginning with going after affirmative action. And the Democrats being on their heels, and me, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, I don't see any difference between a Democrat and a Republican. It seems like one reacts off of the other, and it's just going back and forth. Pence has not allowed anybody that has a voice or the voiceless to be able to, you know, present their views. And the question that I have for your panel is this just another smoke screen just before going to war?
Smoke screen before just going to war? We don't have a panel. We have just the two hosts of this, Larry Vinsky and Robert Knight. You know, this is the back of my mind all the time, Robert, and I imagine it's on your mind a lot, too. When I hear all this discussion about media outlets and freedom of expression, the Bush administration is having a more and more difficult time selling the war scenario.
Well, I would just address this to the caller's point. I would remind the caller that it was under a Democratic president that the 1996 Telecommunications Act that sort of paved the road for this media concentration was enacted with the support of the Clinton administration. The Democrats have, under the leadership of the Democratic Leadership Council conference, become more Republican-esque in the policies that they advocate in a system that they call in Washington bipartisanship, but which is effectively monopartisanship. So I would not make as strong a distinction between conservative tendencies of the Republicans or the Democrats.
And when you look at the coverage of the pre-war maneuverings of the Bush administration on television, it's absolutely appalling. I mean, there's Dan Rather over there in Baghdad, you know, being a hero, and the cable channels escalating their so-called military consultants about where we should bomb here and who we should kill there. And absolutely not a shred of coverage of any dissent until you do things like you read in Time magazine poll that 73% of the people think that the United States is the greatest threat in the world to peace today. Where are those voices represented on all these channels that are rivaling each other for so-called news coverage?
Well, one of the reasons, I think, for that Dan Rather-esque kind of coverage is because it is presumed to be ratings-friendly. And the representation of stories, such as, for instance, the five Mideastern terrorists, it increases the adrenaline. And I know that there are studies that have found that impulse buying following an adrenaline-packed news presentation increases the sales of a product the next day. So I think there's financial motivation there in sort of the tone and alarmist nature of some of the reporting we see.
That's Robert Knight of WBAI in New York. I'm Larry Binsky of KPFA in Berkeley,
Welcome
California.
Back.
And we're going to go back now to the Columbia University Forum.
Larry, as you know, this one is on entertainment, and it will be hearing from representatives from HBO, Thomas Fontana, Clark Herman, a business consultant. Dan Ingram is scheduled from WCBS here and from Astra, and Jenny Tooney of the Future of Music Coalition.
Thomas Fontana?
Bonus guest.
Is that right? Thomas Fontana?
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's coverage of the
Creator
Media Ownership Conference at the Columbia Law School.
Producer of Homicide, Writers Guild of America East, his council member there. Then Clark Herman, Clark Herman Associates, who I think is doing some DTV work right now for broadcasting. David Poltrack, the numbers cruncher at CBS, Executive Vice President of Research and Planning for the CBS Television Network. And Jenny Toomey, Executive Director of the Future of Music Coalition. We'll start with Mr. Fontana. I promised the media folk that I would tell the panelists to speak directly into the microphone. And when you're responding to questions, please look straight ahead so the camera can catch you up there.
How you doing? I'm not a politician. I'm not a businessman. I'm not a lobbyist. As you can see, I don't even own a tie. I don't have any opinions about for or against government regulation. And I've never been much of a prophet, so I really can't predict the future. I'm here because of one deep emotion, which is fear. Since I started writing and producing 22 years ago, I have watched the face of television change drastically. The networks were once like a mom-and-pop grocery store, and they've now been devoured by conglomerates. In turn, these networks have swallowed up each other. CBS now owns UPN and MTV. NBC owns PAX and MSNBC. ABC owns ESPN and Lifetime. In a contradiction worthy of Lewis Carroll, there are now more networks than ever, and yet there are fewer of them. So, 8 years ago, after considerable struggle, the FinCEN rules were dropped. At the time, the heads of the networks assured us that nothing would change. They might as well have offered us sail on the Brooklyn Bridge. I was lucky enough to get my start at one of the best independent production companies ever, MTM. They made the Mary Tyler Moore Show, Lou Grant, Hill Street Blues, The White Shadow, St. Elsewhere. And MTM was not independent just because it wasn't owned by someone else, but because Grant Tinker made decisions based on both business savvy and a passion for quality. Because he backed his attitudes with his own money, Grant was fearless when fighting against the dumbing down of his products. His extraordinary vision nurtured several generations of TV's best talent, including many women and minorities. Because FinCEN is no more, MTM is no more, sucked into a black hole at Fox. Sometimes by deregulating a big business, you can choke the life out of a small one. Without FinCEN, many other fundamental practices in our industries have corroded over time, but in the interest of brevity, I won't go through each point, except to say that once again we are being told that if the dual network rule is abandoned, nothing will change. You can see why some of us would be doubtful. What we aren't is naive. We all know that commercial television exists to make money. At its heart, television is capitalism. In fact, television is democracy. The networks compete for advertising dollars and attractive demographics, and that competition fuels the economy. Television is also democracy because it is our only national town hall. Television is where divergent points of view can be expressed, where conflicting opinions can be argued, not just within one segment of Meet the Press, but from program to program. The brutality of NYPD Blue is balanced by the spirituality of Touched by an Angel. Drew Carey's Cleveland balances Fraser Crane's Seattle. Bill O'Reilly balances Ted Koppel. Yet NYPD Blue, at the time, would have never been put on the CBS schedule. Bill O'Reilly would never be hired by NBC. Certain shows only can exist at certain networks, either because of branding or because of some executive's individual taste. People will say there's diversity simply because of the sheer number of networks currently available. But in truth, many series are now repurposed, airing on cable several days after its initial broadcast premiere. These shows, however, are not offered for sale on the open market, as has been traditionally done, but are automatically going to an entity tied completely to a major network. For example, the AB series Life with Bonnie will be repurposed on the Family Channel because both the broadcast network and the cable network are owned by Disney. This back alley deal diminishes a program's long-term value. So much for free enterprise, so much for diversity. By abandoning current FCC rules, we risk reducing the number of major networks. We run the risk of eliminating small businesses. We run the risk of limiting original thought and freedom of expression. Like I said, I'm no prophet, but to me these risks are far too great. By changing the rules, television will not necessarily get better. Not for me as a writer and a producer, not for me as a viewer, not for me as a stockholder, and not for me as an American. So I ask you to think long and hard before you rewrite history. And I want to leave you with one final thought. There are two countries each which have only one network, Iraq and North Korea. Thank you very much.
Thomas Fontana is the creator of Oz on HBO and the producer of Homicide, speaking about artistic indenture because of corporate connections in the media.
She is Elizabeth Ziff. She's a member of the rock group Betty, and the rock group has put together a musical which, according to Flyer, rules off-Broadway. Elizabeth, do you want to come up?
Hello, everybody. So I was asked at the last minute to be here because musicians are always the last people to, you know, find out about things. We're too busy drinking and stuff like that late at night. So I pried myself out of bed and decided to come and represent. So here I am representing. I'm an independent artist, actually, so I'm a special kind of musician, one of a bigger group, as it were, the little people. The people who haven't been taken into the conglomerations and the corporations, they pretty much dictate what goes on the radio now, as far as we're concerned. My life has been dedicated to being an independent musician, not because so much of want, but because of necessity. If you're not signed to a major label, if you don't have music that's played on the radio easily and available to most people in the country, which is progressively getting smaller and smaller, which is what we've seen. My coworker and I, Allison Palmer. Get up, Allison. Show the people who you are. We traveled the country for years with my sister, who's also in the band, and other musicians, trying to get into clubs and playing them, and being on small radio stations in college towns, and once in a while getting on National Public Radio, which has been an oasis in our career. And we've stayed alive through small radio stations and through college campuses and through television, which we had a show on. And farsightedly, our lawyer instructed us to keep our publishing rights on this television show that we did on HBO called Encyclopedia in 1989. And we were the first artists ever on CTW to retain our publishing. And because of that, we've been able to stay alive because of the visuals. So something like that is good when you don't have... they weren't a big enough corporation at the time to say, no, you cannot do this. We will not hire you. We'll go find somebody else. They just didn't do it. And traveling the country since 1987, we found that it's harder and harder to get on the radio. There was a station in Washington, D.C. where we started called WHFS, which was a fantastic radio station. And it was before it was owned by corporations. And anybody could get on there as long as people liked the music. And people could call in and say, hey, can you play Betty on the radio? And they would play it. And even now, when you go to Woodstock, New York, which has a great radio station, they do play stuff, but they also have a playlist now. They've been bought. And so when somebody does call up, which is usually me, and says, can you play Betty on the radio? Even in Woodstock, New York, they won't play it on WDST because they have a playlist. And that's what's happened over the last 15 to 20 years that we've seen as independent artists that have affected us personally in our career. You can't get played on the radio unless you have a huge machine behind you, because all of these radio stations are either owned by the same people or listen to the same people or get some sort of payola from the same people. So this is why we can't go in the direction that we've been going in for the past 10 years. 15 years of making it a smaller group of people that own a larger piece of pie, because the smaller people will get left out. And in the long run, everybody loses because you don't have enough music out there. And people want to hear different kinds of music. And that's what we found out in our career, because people keep coming to see us. And even if they haven't found us on the radio, they find us in other ways. And they continue to support smaller acts because they're craving diversity, and that's what we need as artists, and we have a responsibility as politicians, as lobbyists, as people who own radio stations to keep that diversity alive. Thanks.
Elizabeth Ziff is one of three women comprising the rock band Betty. She is a frequent guest of WBAI. This is Pacifica Radio, accessible at pacifica.org. Clark Herman is with Herman Associates. He is a business consultant.
Thank you, Harry. Thank you very much to Columbia Law School, Professor Ginsburg, for inviting me here today, my friends from Organized Labor. I am Clark Herman. I'm a consultant for NBC. I work on legislative and regulatory issues. Have been involved with most of the fights that have been referred to today, financial interest and syndication rules, Satellite Home Viewer Act, cable re-regulation, and most recently ownership caps. I work on putting together coalitions on behalf of my clients. I'm also involved in other issues at the FCC involving digital rights management and the tuner mandate proposal put forward by the FCC. I'd like to talk a little bit about the ownership cap issue as it relates to this this venue today. I'm reminded of a comment that I heard from a consumer advocate that I was visiting in Washington. They had just received a visit from a Microsoft lobbyist, and they heard that the representative from NBC was coming in to follow them. And the lobbyist says, oh, you mean that company that's going to be toast in a couple of years? That comment struck me, because that's exactly what companies like Microsoft think of free over-the-air television. Something to keep in mind. As Chairman Powell eloquently said this morning, the FCC has been charged to look at the facts regarding competition, diversity, and localism. And I would argue that as far as the issue of competition is concerned and concentration, there's actually been deconcentration in over-the-air television since the inception of these rules after World War II. At a time when there were only three networks, there were originally two networks. I was just reminded upstairs that there were originally two networks, and the FCC forced NBC to divest one and establish an additional network. So then there were three, at a time when the networks controlled 95% plus share of the viewing audience. So I ask the audience and everybody who's listening to look specifically at the facts regarding ownership caps. The over-the-air share of the national audience has been reduced by 50% approximately since the inception of the rules. More and more viewers are watching the pay services, cable and satellite. Cable and satellite now collectively has 90 million subscribers approximately, or 85% of the viewing market. The over-the-air national audience is down to about 15%. The number of broadcast networks has gone from 3 to 7 in the last 10 years. There are over 200 cable channels and 404 million websites. There are 150 channels average on DBS for the average viewer. Basic cable is spending over $4 billion a year in programming. The cable companies are spending several billion dollars a year for first-run movie rights. There's been an enormous migration of programming, particularly good sports programming, to cable. My client, NBC, does not show football, basketball, hockey, or baseball anymore, because if they did, they'd be losing money. Because sports renegotiation contracts have gone up over an average of 145%. Networks suffer from a basic inequity as far as the cable industry and pay services are concerned. As everybody in here knows, if you're a cable or a satellite subscriber, they have a dual revenue stream. They get revenues from advertising and from subscription. Networks have one source of revenue, and that's advertising exclusively. Please, commissioners, keep that in mind as you go on into this proceeding. There is, in addition, a huge regulatory disparity, and I see I have little time left, but this is the last point I'm going to make. It was referred to before that the cable regs, the rule on cable ownership, referred to 30%. Let me remind everybody that that is 30% of the actual viewing audience. The 35% cap on ownership, as far as the networks are concerned, refers to a potential audience. And if you look at the facts and the figures, the actual viewing audience of the network on a national basis, on average, per night, and this is directly from the sweeps and Nielsen, is less than 3%. So that's hardly monolithic. Thank you very much.
Clark Herman is the president of Clark S. Herman Associates, a business consultancy. Dave Polk appears to be a substitution for Dan Ingram.
Rapidly. So, excuse me, but I want to get it all on. Thank you for the opportunity to share with you my perspective on the television programming issues related to the deregulation of the FCC's broadcast ownership rules. Several of those addressing you today are not only opposing the deregulation initiative involving the FCC's broadcast ownership rules, they are proposing the reversal of the 1993 elimination of the financial interest and syndication rules. While I disagree with their position, I welcome the opportunity to discuss the impact to date of the elimination of these rules on the television programming activities of the broadcast networks. I believe that this discussion will not only demonstrate the positive results of the elimination of the FinCEN rules, but also serve to demonstrate the potential benefits of future deregulation. The best way to frame this discussion is to look back at the period just prior to the elimination of the rules and analyze what has changed in the network television programming market since that time. Before you today are representatives from the creative community, from the advertising industry, and from the broadcast industry. These individuals are speaking on behalf of their sector and focusing on how that sector will either be harmed or will buy or benefit from the proposed deregulation. However, in your deliberations, the key constituency is the viewing public. How will the public be served by this deregulation? I'd like to devote the remainder of my allotted time to a demonstration of how the public has been served by the elimination of the financial interest and syndication rules. First of all, the number of hours that the average individual spends watching television has increased 14% from 4 hours to 4.5 hours since the initiation of these rules. I would argue that this increased level of viewing demonstrates that the public is responding favorably to the enhanced quantity and diversity of programming offered today. One reason that the viewer is watching more today is the increased amount of program options from which to choose. In 1995, the average viewing home received 40 channels of television programming. Shortly, Nielsen will release the number for 2002, and that number will have passed the 100 level. 102, to be exact. The four major broadcast networks represent just 4% of the average viewer's programming choices. Even if you combine all of the cable television networks owned by the parent companies of these broadcast networks with the company's broadcast holdings, you only account for approximately one quarter of the average viewer's choices every day when they turn on their television. Second, the number of different programs aired by the television networks in a season has not changed significantly. The four networks aired 125 different regularly scheduled programs during the 1994-95 television season. These four networks aired 134 different regularly scheduled programs during the just completed 2001-2002 season and have already aired 101 different programs in the first half of this season. And in response to the growing competition from cable television, the networks have increased the number of their original programming this summer. So the networks, freed from the constraints of the rules, are offering viewers more, not less choice today. Back in the 1990s, the proponents of the FinCEN rules argued that without these rules, the networks would favor those programs in which they had a financial interest. The networks allegedly would keep these programs on the air, even though they were attracting only a marginal number of viewers, in order to recoup their investments. Those favoring the rules claimed that this would prevent more deserving programs from reaching the viewers. This has certainly not been the case. In the years leading up to 1993, the networks returned approximately one-third of the programs introduced each season for a second season. For the last three seasons, the retention has remained at that one-third level. It is generally considered necessary for a program to complete three seasons on a television network primetime schedule to be a candidate for syndication. Those opposing the elimination of the rules in 1995 claimed that the networks would keep programs in which they had a significant financial interest on for, would keep programs that had a financial interest on even though they had, were performing marginally in order to get to this 3 years. In the series immediately preceding the sunsetting of the rules in 1993, eight to ten of the series introduced each year stayed on the schedule for three seasons. For the 1997 through 2000 seasons, the average was just seven programs. There is no evidence that the networks are keeping more marginal series on their schedules now than they have financial interest in these series. The network television programs market is an intensely competitive market. Only the strongest programs survive. So far, my survey has not shown any network program market changes of significance since the start of the rules. However, there has been one significant change. The composition of the network lineups has changed. Of the 129 different programs for the four networks in the 1994-95 season, almost one half, 46%, were situation comedies. Today, only 30% of the programs are situation comedies. I have to wrap up, so I'll cut. But the new entry into the program, the network program arena, is reality programming. Today, reality programming is 15% of total programming. It was only 5% back then. There's a chorus of commenters in the FCC's ownership proceeding, most of whom are in the business of producing sitcoms and movies of the week, the two genres being genres partially being replaced. Is that my phone? No, that phone. I'm sorry. Can you answer the phone, Harris?
This is my job. Hello?
Now, I'm wrapping up now. That doesn't come out of my time, Harry. There is a chorus of commenters in the FCC's ownership proceedings, most of whom are in the business of producing sitcoms and movies of the week, the two genres being partially displaced by this new reality program, that are regularly decrying the change in the composition of the television programming landscape. It may therefore come as a surprise to you that I'm going to cite this programming trend as an example of how the public is today benefiting from the elimination of the financial interest and syndication rules.
The speaker is Dave Poltrack, representing WCBS. He is speaking in apparent substitution for Dan Ingram of WCBS FM, an FM pop oldie station based here in New York. Dan Ingram, of course, is the master of the comedic haiku, joke voiced over the opening of a pop song, and he is a longtime veteran of WABC as well as WCBS Radio here in New York. I think Dave Poltrack is still online.
Yeah, but the interesting thing about that, Robert Knight, is that Dan Ingram was going to be speaking as a representative of the